Welcome back to the program. In New York, a new school recently opened called the Avenue School, with a curriculum focused on turning out global citizens. It's tuition $40,000 a year, and some parents are willing to pay it because they see the value of their kids engaging in the challenges of the 21st century global environment. We often say that we're concerned when we fall behind much of the developed world in our math and science scores. The reality is that there's a bigger threat. That is the degree to which most of our students are not engaged with the larger world. Their lack of knowledge of the world, its differences, its cultures, its geography, and its languages are all areas that will serve to hold back American students in a rapidly globalizing society. We're going to take a look at this today with my guest, Carl Hobart. He's a clinical instructor in the Boston University School of Education. He also directs the Axis of Hope Center for International Conflict Management and Prevention, and is the author of a new book entitled Raising Global IQ, Preparing Our Students for a Shrinking Planet. Carl Hobart, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. It's hard to think about teaching our students to become better and more open global citizens when we seem to be so narrowly focused on things like test scores in science and math at this point. It seems like we have to get past the first hurdle before we get to the second.
Right. No, it's a very good question. I mean, if you look at books like Tom Friedman's The World is Flat, it shows what's going on out in the world and in other countries where, for example, in Great Britain, in France, in Spain, in Germany, in Finland, in India, many different foreign countries, they're all looking at the importance of learning many languages in kids' formative years because the world is getting smaller every day. And if we don't do that in our own country, looking at a language beyond English and being able to say to people, hey, you think that English is the most important language in the world. It is a very important language, but we've got to move beyond this because of the changing economic environment today. That's what we've got to start to think about in schools, where we have to look at Spanish, Arabic, Mandarin Chinese, and other important foreign languages and start to teach them to kids in their formative years of lives when they're going to be learning it more effectively.
As we look at this and as we try and incorporate it into some schools, places like the Avenue School in New York and certainly other schools around the country, are we not at the same time furthering some of the cultural and economic divides we see in the country because we're putting such a high premium on this and basically making it a kind of an elitist part of education today?
Such a good question. If you look at the Avenues, and I'm so glad you're talking about this, it brings together so many former heads of the greatest independent schools in our country, meaning the greatest prep schools. One, for example, the former headmaster of Phillips Exeter Academy in New Hampshire. They all know by looking at their parent boards and their boards of trustees that this is the way we've got to move in the future. So they've all come together in Manhattan with the ideas of globalization of education, starting with foreign language acquisition early in life, because they know that eventually schools across the country are going to have to wake up and smell the coffee, as I often say, and do exactly the same thing. And if you look at our waves in the past of things like, for example, technology, and having to teach students and teachers the importance of technology in the classroom, and now today the whole idea of the globalization of curricula, these are realities, and it's often very difficult for U.S. schools to look at these realities and really change how they're teaching students. But it's here, it's never going away, and I've got to tell people that this book is meant to be a roadmap for how to do it effectively.
And yet, because schools and education, whether we like it or not, is part of the political equation in this country, the kind of isolationist and self-serving streak that is part of our politics today is still part of our educational system.
You're absolutely right. Isolationism is a big part of the U.S. education system, and so much of it is what I call the gerbil wheel, where you've got parents and teachers and administrators saying to students, starting when they're very young, you've got to do well on standardized exams to get into good colleges and then take good or do well on standardized exams to get into good graduate schools to make a lot of money. We've got to rethink what we're doing and get away from just reliance on standardized exams like the SAT, the SAT2, the AP, and start to think about what's going on in the world and improve the skills of students in terms of foreign language acquisition, as I mentioned before, the use of technology to connect with other societies around the world, the whole idea of conflict management and prevention, how to be able to step into different areas of conflict around the world and help these cultures move through conflict more effectively as the powerful Americans. Another big item I bring up in the book is the whole idea of service learning based on John Dewey, being able to learn how to serve others in the classroom and then get out in the field and do it. These are all parts of reality in the 21st century that move away from memorization and regurgitation to get better scores on standardized exams.
One of the things that we're seeing, whether education teaches it or not, is we're seeing in many cases the students get way out ahead of the educational system, partly because of technology, their ability to be in contact with peoples from around the world and friends from around the world. They're way ahead of where education is.
And one of the things I think we've got to move away from as we allow kids to do that is what I call the quick fix, where they quickly check out CNN headlines without actually reading profoundly into what's going on, using Twitter very quickly because they're limited to a certain number of characters they can put in there, using Facebook to be able to send out quick messages full of exclamation points and full of photos at parties. We've got to start to rethink how technology is being used to allow our students to understand more profoundly, back to things I talked about before that are reality, foreign languages, what's going on in the world from a geopolitical point of view, how to serve others, and literally move away from two-dimensional in front of a screen or holding your iPhone to getting out there in the field after being better prepared in the classroom and in the living room for that experiential education. This is the movement we've got to look at in terms of education in the future. No more quick fix, students.
But yet you still talk about that it is possible to take the current curriculum and kind of remodel it, as you say, to look out towards a more global focus as opposed to a major renovation involving pulling it all up by its roots.
You're absolutely right. This is where we've got to rethink what we do in our schools, where students are already comfortable in the halls with peers whom they know and being able to say, okay, students, here you've got passionate teachers, teachers who are passionate about what's going on in the world, be able to get into classrooms that involve the students more as opposed to just lecturing and having the students memorize and regurgitate material, as I said before. So number one, we've got to work on a better, more energetic pedagogy. Number two, we've got to be able to look at students and say, okay, you're in these great classrooms, you're able to take more part in your educational process through experiential learning right there in the classroom. Number three, being able to use technology to connect those students with students elsewhere in the world, not necessarily to talk about the parties that they've been to, but to talk about complex global issues, things that are going on, for example, in the Middle East right now after Benjamin Netanyahu was reelected Prime Minister of Israel. And imagine being able to have students not only talk about things like that, but boy, think about those students in an American school who have learned Arabic in addition to Hebrew and are able to speak in the target languages to those kids in the Middle East. And I finish with this. Imagine being able to look at U.S. curricula. We now offer across the country in the junior year of high school U.S. history or AP U.S. history courses. We should have a contemporary global issues course as a necessity somewhere during the high school years, possibly senior year before the students go on to college. This is how important it is to start teaching our students about what's going on in the world.
One of the ironies, and you touch on this in Raising Global IQ, is that in many ways 9/11, because it brought the world here to us, should have been a powerful catalyst for exactly what you're talking about. In many ways, it has had precisely the opposite effect.
You're absolutely right. It's caused us to feel so much of a fear, almost a paranoia, that it's been like we've dug a moat around ourselves and we've pulled up the gate and we've said, this is what's going on in other countries around the world. We've got to get stronger. We've almost got to inject ourselves with a sort of superior kind of steroid to be able to stick with English as the language of the world, to be able to show that we're the most powerful from a military point of view, and don't mess with us. Well, I've got to tell you, I have crisscrossed the world, and I have worked with and taught students from kindergarten through graduation from college. What's going on out there is people are looking at us and starting to say, what an amazing country, but they don't want to respect other countries. For example, Afghanistan and the Taliban. For example, Iraq. And I'm not saying I agree with all the peoples in all these countries, but we have a fear of all the Chinese people that are coming to this country in those tour buses and wanting things their way, in their language, with their food, etc. Imagine the same feeling of people in other countries around the world who are looking at Americans the same way, and not just coming in tour buses, coming in C-135 transport planes with tanks and with plenty of armaments. So we've got to start to rethink not only how we're teaching our students about what's going on in the world, but how to improve our somewhat tarnished reputation around the world and allow people to think, wow, we actually respect Americans because they do have an improved global IQ and have respect for other societies.
Isn't the problem, though, deeper than what we're talking about, in that there is this long American strain of American hegemony, American isolationism, this sense of inwardness that really goes back to even the earliest days of the Republic?
You're absolutely right, but colleague Paul Kennedy at Yale wrote The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, and he said, United States, take a look at isolationism by looking at other empires throughout history, Greece, Rome, Western Europe. And as they started to expand after wars, similar to the United States after World War II, having to have our forces in different places around the world, you, yes, have to extend yourself, but what starts to happen is almost a form of overextension and that idea of looking within and thinking, how are we going to continue to push our own agenda here in this country to those other places around the world? And what Paul brings up at the end of the book is overextension leads to not explosion, but implosion. And that's my biggest fear in this country. Unless we teach schools, administrators, teachers, as well as parents and students, how to raise global IQ and look at history and say, this whole idea of hegemony, this whole idea of superiority, is going to lead to implosion if we're not careful. And look what's already happening in different places around the world vis-a-vis the United States. Thank goodness we're pulled out of Iraq. Thank goodness we're pulling out of Afghanistan. But are we going to have to continue to be the biggest kid on the block? Well, you know who's looking over our shoulder is China. And China knows darn well that we have overextended, and as it continues to extend itself into places like Africa for minerals, they know that we've gone a little bit too far post-World War II.
I want to come back to something you've talked about before and that you discuss in Raising Global IQ, and that is the importance of language as really the door into cultural fluency as well as language fluency.
The idea of teaching students in their formative years about foreign languages and about foreign cultures, because learning something about another culture is a language in and of itself. That's so important because you know what it does? It starts to set students apart from an ordinarily monolingual, monocultural society. So already you're able to say to students, I taught French and Spanish for years here in the Boston area, being able to say, set yourself apart. Learn a foreign language and learn it well. You know what you do? You not only learn a language that you can put on your resume someday, but you learn how to learn another language, which makes language 3, 4, and 5 so much easier. And once you learn about the language, get out there and learn about the culture also, because what you're stimulating is not just the brain of students through the ear. Once you get students out learning about other cultures, you're stimulating the nose and new smells, the taste buds, and new foods. The eyes, what they're seeing, the touch. I take students to Rwanda every other summer. Can you imagine what it's like learning not just French and English, but a little bit of Kinyarwanda, their regional dialect, and then getting over there, eating the foods of the area, seeing what happened back in 1994 at the height of the genocide, walking into the Home of Hope orphanage right down the hill from Hotel Rwanda and smelling feces and urine and working with these little children. It is an out-of-body experience that completely transforms students before they graduate from high school. So it's that whole idea of moving away from monoculturalism, monolingualism, to being able to teach students how to learn more profoundly about other cultures through language. And it uses the ear and a certain portion of the brain in the formative years to develop those skills that never go away. If you don't do that in the formative years of life, two people have profoundly helped me with this whole project. One is Suzanne Flynn. The other is Noam Chomsky over at MIT, both linguists. And Noam Chomsky has some interesting things to say politically. But in terms of their knowledge of early childhood language acquisition, they've taught me, Carl, get the word out. We've got to do this in the United States in terms of language acquisition early. If not, those kids hit adolescence and pruning takes place. Certain parts of the brain shut down and they're not going to be able to acquire languages as effectively later in life. Stand up on the pulpit and say, we have got to work with kids earlier in life on foreign languages.
What do we need to be doing within our schools of education so that we're turning out teachers that in and of themselves become and feel comfortable being global citizens?
You are absolutely right. I actually met with Arne Duncan. We had over an hour-long conversation about the importance of globalization of education in this country, and it does have to start with teachers. One of his comments back to me was, one of the issues we've got is the folks who have been in those classrooms for years are protected by unions, are monocultural and monolingual, and just don't want to do this. And I said to him, think about a new incentive plan for better multicultural, multilingual teachers. Getting them when they come out of college, getting them into classrooms so they can really start to grapple with this issue as young, energetic teachers who are going to influence these kids in positive ways. And I also said to him, this has got to start from the top, meaning the United States Department of Education. So we no longer look upon teachers as the underpaid with a lot of vacation time. We look at teachers as they do in Finland, as fast-track, successful, respected people who are going to get in there and affect our kids in a positive way. We've got to pay them well, and we've got to create excellent programs at schools of education around the country so that it doesn't become all a possibility for a couple of years through Teach for America. It becomes a noble career path, and this is exactly why I took our program, Axis of Hope, and exactly why I did my research on raising global IQ to Boston University, where the School of Education has housed our program for so many years. And imagine this, right around the corner, before he passed away, was historian Howard Zinn. Right across the street is the office of Elie Wiesel. Two people who have had a profound influence on me and what we have to do as soon as possible with kids.
I want to talk a little bit about Axis of Hope, because one of the things that it all rolls back into is this idea of conflict resolution, and that it's really by understanding the other, whether it's the other diverse involving diversity in the classroom or others around the world, that that's the only way in to resolving conflicts that exist.
What we do at Axis of Hope is write case studies on geopolitical conflicts like the Arab-Israeli conflict, where the first chapter is 20 pages of history. They learn the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict. The second chapter is chronology or a timeline, all the way from pre-1900 up to modern day. Many students in U.S. high schools do not know what happened during 1967 and the Six-Day War. The third chapter is a glossary. Who is Benjamin Netanyahu? A lot of U.S. students don't know that he actually grew up in the Philadelphia area, went to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and MIT's Sloan School of Management. We also put in there, for example, who was Yasser Arafat, who's Abu Mazen or Mahmoud Abbas. And the important thing, back to language, you weave into each case study on a geopolitical conflict somewhere else in the world the languages of all sides involved. What is Intifada? what's jihad, even putting in something like chutzpah, so that kids are starting to get an idea of the importance of language acquisition when they negotiate someday, if they become career negotiators, career diplomats. But the interesting thing is the last side, or the last chapter, creating six different sides in the conflict that students are going to have to role play. Would you, I'll ask you this question, want to be a member of Hamas, Fatah, Likud, Labor, the Arab League, or the Quartet headed by the United States? Mm-hmm. If I asked you that as a student, what would you like to be?
I'd say Labor.
Well, guess what I do as I teach history teachers around the country to do this and to prepare the students before I or someone from Axis of Hope comes? I'd say, great, you're being honest with me. I'm going to ask you to be a member of Hamas during the negotiation. So you have to learn how to walk in the shoes of others. It's like a good NFL quarterback knowing how to walk in the shoes of everyone on the defense by doing film analysis. And then before we start negotiations, where the students in a particular high school are divided into these six groups, so let's say 60 kids divided into groups of 10 at 10 different, or six different tables, I connect those students via live video conference with their peers all over the Middle East I've worked with through the Seeds of Peace camp during the summer in the state of Maine. They find out from their peers what's going on there and how to play their roles well. Over the course of the day, the students in small groups have to argue over the division of Jerusalem, and by the end of the day, representing their sides well, they have to come up with a 250-word position paper that they all sign, a copy of which is sent to Barack Obama, and it used to be sent to Hillary Rodham Clinton. Now it's sent to Senator John Kerry, who's become Secretary of State. And these people are fascinated by how we're starting to rethink U.S. education by looking at global issues that they're dealing with every day.
I want to touch, in the little bit of time we have left, I want to touch on one other aspect of this that we have overlooked, and that is how important this is for the business community and why it's critical to train these students in the ways we're talking about for the future of business in this country.
Oh, you're asking all the perfect questions today. Number one, imagine U.S. business expansion into other cultures we don't even understand. So being able to get a better fix on, through language and culture, other cultures where you're thinking about expanding business. But imagine being able to take a geopolitical conflict that's half a world away and learn negotiation skills by role-playing different sides in that conflict. And then being able to think, wow, I can apply so many of these lessons that I learned playing a member of Hamas that I might not agree with to my own life. Listen to these. Listen. The word listen in any negotiations, geopolitically or in the business world, listen spelled another way is silent. So you should be listening more, be more silent whenever you're in talks where people are feeling a little bit of friction. You've got two ears and one mouth. You should listen twice as much as you speak. Three important words in negotiation: smart, tough, and fair. Another term I teach students coming out of the book Getting to Yes by two great mentors, Fisher and Urey, BATNA, B-A-T-N-A, standing for Best Alternative to a Negotiated Agreement. If you're in a business meeting and you can't come up with a negotiated agreement, you have a BATNA, or two or three or more. One might be, let's break for lunch, let's get some fresh air, and come back after lunch and continue this discussion. Those are the nuggets you're teaching kids through these exercises that develop a new fluency in kids in their formative years that they can apply at the dining room table, they can apply with their friends, they can apply in the locker room, they can apply in business years from now. You want to talk about the injection we need in the U.S. economy? You put your finger on it right here, Raising Global IQ.
Carl Hobart, his book is Raising Global IQ, Preparing Our Students for a Shrinking Planet. Carl, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's been a pleasure and really an honor to be on your show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.